The following is a CNA podcast.
I'm Jamie Ho, and thanks for listening to The Climate Conversations. Today, I'm talking about Malaysia's 2050 net zero emissions targets. Prime Minister Ismail Sabri announced the country's goal of reaching net zero by 2050 at the earliest when he unveiled the 12th Malaysia Plan in Parliament. He outlined a slew of measures to get the country to net zero, such as an end to new coal-fired power plants, more installed renewable energy, and a carbon tax. But how achievable is net zero by 2050 for Malaysia? What would it mean for its economy, from fossil fuels to palm oil? Or can it be a leader in Southeast Asia? With me today is Hezri Adnan, Executive Director of the Malaysian Institute of Economic Research. He's also the former CEO of the Langkawi Development Authority and specializes in sustainable development solutions across fields like the green economy and natural resources governance. Hezri, welcome.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you for inviting me to the climate conversation.
I want to get to the first question. Tell us your reaction when you first heard of Malaysia's carbon neutral goal. Were you surprised, or were there already signs that policymakers were gearing up towards it?
I was very optimistic and upbeat when I heard that, because given what's going on in the country, the fact that the leadership can still pay more attention to climate change is really welcoming. I thought the emphasis on climate change is not new in Malaysia, but of course the question is on the implementation.
Since you mentioned that, talk us through, in your view, how successive governments have taken on climate change, stepping up not just domestic action, but internationally as well, I would presume. How has this government under PM Ismail Sabri differed potentially from earlier ones, from PM Najib to PM Mahathir to Muhyiddin, on climate change and larger sustainability issues?
Malaysia has always been instrumental in international negotiations on sustainable development in general, also particularly climate change and biodiversity. Together with India and Brazil, we were very instrumental in getting the development component to be part and parcel of international negotiation way back in the first Rio in 1992. And since then, our leadership on climate change issues with a number of countries has taken a number of guises. This is at international level, yeah? But it's always in the interest of protecting the developing world. And this distinction between the developed and the developing countries has always been there. We've also managed to get the civil society in Malaysia to be interested along the same line. For instance, the Third World Network is a very known international NGO, started from Penang and started to sort of play on the common but differentiated responsibility. So internationally, it's always been playing a role there, particularly in emphasizing the role of developing countries. Within the country, of course, 2009 was the watershed year when the green technology portfolio was introduced by Prime Minister Najib. Along with that, we had the Sustainable Energy Development Authority established, and a few other sectoral plans were also made to the fore at the policy level. There's been a number of adjustments along the years. From, in 2009, we had a 40% reduction carbon intensity that was conditional tech transfer and also fund from developed countries. In 2016, we upgraded that after Paris Agreement to 45% by 2030 emission intensity per GDP. And then there was a couple of weeks ago when Prime Minister Ismail Sabri announced that 45% reduction based on 2030 GDP. And this is unconditional. It sort of have evolved over the years. I think this is very welcoming. The implementation is the challenge, of course.
So I was going to get to the implementation. And if we look at the longer term 2050 goal, or 2050 at the earliest, as the PM said, as far as net zero emissions are concerned, when you look at the overall structure of the Malaysian economy, and it's the same thing for countries like Singapore and elsewhere as well, when you look at the overall structure of it, there will be parts of it which are dependent on petrochemicals and other sort of emissions intensive industries. How do you think Malaysia's economy will start evolving between now and towards its goal of 2050, structurally as well, moving away towards certain industries or helping them transition? And then when you look at that kind of decarbonizing economy, where will new revenue streams be coming on for the Ministry of Finance, for example?
Excellent question. The emphasis by Malaysia over the years has always been to combine, you know, forest conservation with increasing renewable energy into the energy mix. And we're also focusing on low carbon cities or promotion of public transportation and green urban planning. So that's always been the sort of a holy trinity of Malaysian response. Moving forward, we need to ask the hard question and address, as we put it, the dependency on oil and gas, for instance. And this is where I think the recent emphasis on hydrogen economy will be, if well undertaken, will be the game changer for, you know, the hard to decarbonize sectors like the haulage or transportation sectors, and also the oil and gas sectors. I noticed that the government, since Tan Sri Muhyiddin took over, then similarly with Ismail Sabri, is continuing along this line of looking at hydrogen economy as a game changer. The welcoming news is the fact that now the Sarawak government is putting more efforts. In fact, it's the most advanced when it comes to hydrogen economy. They are encouraged of what's happening in Brunei. You know, Japan is importing hydrogen from Brunei. So there is this neighborhood rivalry there. These are the kind of new things that have to happen for us to decarbonize the hard to decarbonize sectors.
I think a lot of it also will come from this so-called Green Tech Master Plan. You've been a bit involved in that. Tell us a bit about that as well. And in rough strokes, where does Malaysia see the potential for green tech?
Green tech has been put in place since 2009, you know, but it's been a slow uptake over the years. I remember in 2009 or 2010, the government announced a green technology financing scheme amounting to 1 billion ringgit Malaysia at that time. I remember it was oversubscribed, you know, in the first day it was announced. The tough call happened when they approached the bank. So this is a government guaranteed soft loan program. And the banks were not very sure of how to deal with the risk of green technology financing, you know. So it has taken some years for the country to begin to get our act together in terms of that. But I left the environment scene for a couple of years to take up a position in government, mainly focusing on tourism. But when I returned recently to the environment fraternity, I am very surprised with the level of interest in the private sector, in government, in civil society. For 20 years, we happen only to, you know, bump into the same people in all meetings. But now there are so many new players. I can name a few new groups like the Climate Action Network, a group of young members, grassroots group. 85% of them are below 25, and 70% of them are women. There's also a Climate Governance Malaysia, which is this chapter of the World Economic Forum Climate Governance Initiative, a network of non-executive directors. These are the new players in the scene, and they're pushing the government, pushing the society to increase their attention on climate change. So it's very welcoming, I would say.
Interesting you said that, because I can see the parallels here, over here in Singapore as well, because in the last 2, 3, 4 years as well, there's a significant uptick in not just civil society, but also government, private sector interest, the finance sector interest in terms of how you do green financing. So yeah, it's been an exciting couple of years for the overall sector in our part of the world for sure. I wanted to now talk again a little bit about something which, again, Singapore has also been grappling with, and I'm sure Malaysia will grapple with it at some point, is the power generation and how we generate energy for our economies, right? According to the IEA, the share of natural gas in the power mix for Malaysia actually fell a little bit between 2005 and 2015 because of declining domestic gas production. So Malaysia, to some extent, is reliant on coal, and your PM has said that he hopes to replace coal power plants with gas-fired plants. How will this transition take place? Do you have a goal in your own mind as to how quickly this can realistically take place? And I suppose, as we've said earlier, these are going to be dependent on quite significant shifts in the Malaysian economic structure if they're going to move away from emissions-intensive power plants such as the coal-fired ones.
If you look at the policy documents or the commitments by people in Putrajaya, you're very encouraged on what's going to happen. But the devil is in the details, as I always say. And this is now being worked out by the government. I think there is a long-term emissions development strategy now being developed. So they're looking at the detailed, you know, accounting of the sectors, including the power sector. And this will only be finalized in end of 2022. So it will take a while before we can begin to see how are we going to prioritize some of these areas. Coming back to coal, this is the challenge. You also see this internationally with the sudden hike in oil price, the emphasis on decarbonization across the world, including the big players like China even. When you take a close look at the recovery package, you know, of many countries, there's one study done. They look at 31 stimulus packages all over the world. It's also only a small fraction given to actually renewable energy, despite what being announced, you know. So there is this discrepancy between what is promised and what is being done. And this is where I think you need more details. And that detail is now being worked out in Malaysia. I look at the 12th Malaysia Plan, which was released on the 27th of September, and now it's being passed by both Dewan Rakyat and Dewan Negara in Malaysia. The word circular economy, for instance, appeared 79 times. So we are not worried when it comes to government commitment on paper, but we are very interested to see, and we should be part and parcel to help the government to really work out the details. Coming back to coal, even the big players like TNB in Malaysia is paying more attention to it. Recently, I was on a webinar, and they have a new section that looks at decarbonization. You know, so it is being worked out, I believe. But one important point that we should note, the past 2 years that you said has brought in new players into this climate change policy domain. The challenge is to get everyone together and to work with the government to detail out so that it won't just be greenwashing.
I'm glad you raised the point about what was supposed to be a green recovery, right? As we had hoped last year at the height of the COVID pandemic, there were suggestions that there will be a surge in sort of economic stimuluses that were green and sustainable, but you know, maybe it hasn't worked out as well as we would have hoped. On the issue of renewables, and hopefully we're getting there sooner rather than later, where do you think renewables will stand in Malaysia's plans to go carbon neutral at some point in time? It wants 31% of installed power capacity to be renewable. So this includes hydropower. In the longer term, as long as you would like, where do you see hydro plus solar and wind for a country like Malaysia?
For hydropower, the big potential has always been tapped in Peninsula, also in Sarawak and also Sabah. Yeah? We are left with the mini hydropower plants. There are still potential in states like Perak, for instance. Sungai Perak has great potential for mini hydro, and that now is being developed by the private sector with government. On the wind side, unfortunately, Peninsula Malaysia does not sit in the wind region, if you like. You know, there's a measure of 1 or 2 meter. So we are not in that map. So we are in a low wind potential area. In Sabah, there is that potential. And that is now being developed as well. I was made to understand recently, there's a company that has just signed on for the development of wind power in Sabah. Solar, there is a spike in interest on large-scale solar systems. Of course, there are other issues related to that, you know, with land use tension and all that. But there is that growing interest in that area as well. The question is, how do you bring everything together? Again, this is where we need a new entity that brings together the different players. Government is in the midst of coming up with a center on climate change. This should be able to bring the different players together. But again, it's not going to happen overnight. So we have to look for another year or 2 more years before this can happen.
You know, countries like us here in Singapore have been looking increasingly into the import of renewable and cleaner energies from other countries. Do you think that this is something that Malaysia may be looking at too, importing more clean, renewable energy? And how would you think this would balance between its own domestic capabilities with fossil fuels, with renewables, plus the potential to import? Would that be an option ever, you think?
That has not been discussed widely as yet in Malaysia, I would say, because we still think that we are a resource-rich country, you know, and everything should be produced here. But just to add to my earlier point about solar in particular is that I remember a senior bureaucrat once said that not all electrons are created equal. There is this question of stability, you know, and intermittency of solar, for instance. Yeah, the way forward for Malaysia is to really look at the technical details and work out how the loose end can be tightened up rather than importing. I think that's a different scenario to Malaysia and Singapore there.
You know, one of the things that were raised most recently was obviously the role of a carbon tax in helping Malaysia reach its goals in the longer term. Carbon taxes everywhere are always going to be controversial politically. Even here in Singapore, there's always going to be some pushback there. How is the Malaysian government, you think, going to transition away from, as it stands now, even fossil fuel subsidies towards, you know, the opposite end of the political spectrum or policy spectrum towards taxing fossil fuel consumption? Is this going to be difficult, you think?
Yeah, it's not going to be a walk, you know, in the garden. But the government has mentioned this, and there's also think tanks like the Penang Institute, for instance, has sort of worked out the detail for what amount of carbon price should Malaysia explore in the next few years. Because we are now looking at sort of expanding our fiscal space in Malaysia. And the Minister of Finance is seriously looking at the introduction of carbon tax. But the question is, what is the pricing and what is the mechanism that's still being worked out? In addition to that is the announcement by the government of the Domestic Emissions Trading Scheme, or DETS. So that is to boost the sort of carbon exchange domestically as well. So these are the kind of ideas in the pipeline, which we're really excited to see how this will pan out. Introduction of new tax in the current situation is not going to be very popular, especially if election is just around the corner. We will have to be very patient in seeing the introduction of these new measures in Malaysia. But the fact that we are talking about it seriously, and I would also hasten to add that the Ministry of Finance in Malaysia has been very proactive in the past 2 years, looking at how the environment can be part and parcel of the new fiscal regime and all that. For instance, in the latest budget, there's a mention of the ecological transfer scheme involving the states. So they've been very proactive. Usually, MOF would be a bit ambivalent about all these things. And we have the Economic Planning Unit in Malaysia that will be pushing for greener measures. But now we are seeing even the Ministry of Finance under the leadership of Tengku Zafrul, who's a banker. I think the banking sector is also responding very aggressively in the sustainability domain. He brings that culture into Ministry of Finance.
Here in Singapore, from the time that the hint was dropped that there will be a carbon tax to eventually setting the rate, and then which was set relatively low in the first place, $5, and then now further hints that it will indeed go up even more in the coming years. That took some time. So I suspect it will probably take as long as that for Malaysia too. But it'll be interesting to see eventually how the rates in the two countries sort of feed off each other, because I suppose there will have to be some degree of looking over the shoulder and seeing what each country does. And hopefully there'll be some room for cooperation as well when it comes to emissions trading schemes and things like that. I wanted to transition now to our last couple of questions. And one of the things that you raised very early on in our conversation was Malaysia's role on the international stage, where it has in the past been at the forefront with fellow developing countries in ensuring that their interests are met and considered in, for example, the international negotiations. Are you keeping an eye on what's happening or what's going to happen in Glasgow? And when you think about what Malaysia can do and what other developing countries want to see happen from COP26, how do you think it's going to pan out? And what do you think is a good outcome for Malaysia?
The financing dimension of the negotiation will be very important, and very important thing to watch for the developing countries in particular. For those who have been observing the development of COP, our best bet is to be cautiously optimistic, because we've seen what happened in Copenhagen. But now is also a very challenging time, given that we are just reeling from the impact of pandemic globally. And most countries are still struggling with the basics of vaccines and burdened on the fiscal space. So, in fact, Malaysia is also sending a smaller delegation to Glasgow this year compared to previous years. And I presume it's going to be the same for other developing countries as well. But we are also seeing more commitments, despite what the awful things that's happening out there. There are greater commitments by many developing countries. I'm cautiously optimistic on the outcome, but we are hoping the big countries will commit more, given that the rest of the world is really reeling from the impact of the pandemic.
As a final question, then, you know, maybe you can give us a little bit of insight into domestically how the Malaysian people, and you made a brief reference to this in terms of the NGOs that have emerged and are playing stronger and stronger roles. Everyone has come through quite a hard period the last 18 months or so with COVID. Malaysia has also had a certain degree of political uncertainty. How difficult is it to move beyond this, start pushing the climate agenda again? And then do you think there's going to be as well a dynamic between the federal government's goals and where does the state governments lie as well in pushing climate and sustainability agendas? Will they have the support of the people? Is there enough interest going forward in the coming years?
The debate on climate change tends to be KL-centric, I would say. But the impact is being felt by people in the rural areas as well. You know, for instance, in places like Kedah, where I am from, there has been a number of drought events that had caused 2 planting seasons to be missed. And that has caused a great deal of suffering for the people there. And if you go to on the ground, you know, particularly during drought time, you can see that the agriculture sector is suffering, particularly for the rice planting areas or the granary areas in Malaysia. There must be an effort to communicate this to the broader public. And I think the growth of more NGOs coming to the fore is something healthy. But the other thing is also related to the hydrological certainties. The flood zones in Malaysia is expanding. For instance, there is one study that looked at the expansion of Batu Pahat flood-prone area. So we are going to see about 200% increase in its area by 2030. Similarly, in Sungai Kelantan, you know, so more people will be affected by floods. And we have to make this discourse something that matters to everyone, not just among the, you know, Putrajaya bubble or the Bangsa bubble of Malaysia. More communication is needed. Most importantly, Jamie, is we have to have a strong voice, environmental voice, in the August House of Parliament. Currently, we don't have anyone championing environment strategically in the Parliament. Hopefully, in the election, the Malaysian public will elect more environmentally conscious people to be their Member of Parliament.
On that very slightly more optimistic note, best of luck to you and Malaysia as well. Hazri Adnan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jamie.
And thanks for listening to The Climate Conversations. Stay up to date on CNA's coverage of climate change on cna.asia. You can also find this and other CNA podcasts on our website and on iTunes and Spotify. The team behind this podcast are Crispina Robert, Lin Su Ling, and Erin Low. And I'm Jamie Ho. Till next week.